Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here, taking a look at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. She comes by once a month to talk with us. And if you have a question, I hope you'll join in. Already a couple of people online, but you can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. or post a photo and or a pet photo and or question on our Facebook page and our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show. I'd love to hear from you. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, welcome back.
Nice to be here, Larry.
Great to have you with us. And, you know, in the last year or two, we began to hear a lot more about canine flu, and I think it's worth talking about for sure.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that I've brought up at other shows as well, but back in 2005, we recognized that there was a type of flu that affected dogs that went by the name H3N8, and we came up with a vaccine for that, and we hardly saw it at all in the Midwest. It was very patchy in certain areas of the United States, mainly down south, like in the Florida area. We saw cases down there, and then this time last year, we had a big outbreak in the Chicago area, and since then, it has been, we found that it is all in every state, but this is a different influenza. It's H3N2. And the reason why I wanted to bring this up is that we're now, with dogs getting out and being in dog parks, now that the weather's getting nicer, maybe people vacationing and boarding their dogs, we're probably going to be seeing more cases of this. And there is a vaccine available for it, and you have to plan ahead. It takes two doses, 2 to 4 weeks apart, and then a couple of weeks after that last vaccination, they're protected. The other interesting kind of new thing that just came out of the vet school here in Madison is that Dr. Newberry, who's our shelter veterinarian at the vet school, found that there was a shelter with a lot of cats that had very similar symptoms to dogs, with kind of runny nose, fever, not feeling well. And guess what? They were diagnosed with canine influenza. So we know that it can affect cats now. So if you have a dog that has respiratory signs, one, pay for the getting it checked. I mean, there are so many things that can cause a dog to have upper respiratory signs, and there's a very easy test that's run through our state diagnostic lab that's just a little throat swab that goes off, and we send that in, and they tell us what's affecting the dog. I had a dog in the other day that I swear had canine influenza, and it ended up turning out to be canine herpes virus, which can cause respiratory problems. I was surprised. The owner was surprised, but at least we knew that it was, you know, something different than influenza. So if you have a dog that's sick, find out what it is if you can, so that, because we just really don't know the incidence in the state, because a lot of dogs just get supportive care and don't get any testing done. And if you have a dog with a respiratory problem, you may want to consider keeping them separated from your cats, just in case. Although it looks like it's pretty rare for cats to get it, it's still one of those things that we don't want, especially elderly cats or very young cats, to pick this up, because they would be the ones that would get very sick compared to healthy cats.
Yeah, wasn't there a big outbreak in Chicago last
year? Yeah, this last time last year. Yeah, it was in the Chicago area. We had a dog from Chicago come up to Madison, and actually that was the dog that we were able to get the virus out and find out that this was a brand new influenza. Our diagnostic lab, in conjunction with Cornell University, ended up finding out that it was this H3N2. Versus the H3N8.
And dogs, typically it's touching noses or rear ends or whatever.
This is what's really interesting about it. The virus can survive on our clothing and things. And so we can take it home to our pets. And so if you're at a friend's house, whatever, you could potentially be bringing this home. So when we have a dog with a respiratory problem, we gown up, we get into like almost like hazmat suits, and they're in a separate location with separate ventilation. Very careful to make sure that anything that touches that animal is left behind in the room, because we don't want to spread it to other animals. Take it home to your own animals. And I have been known to go home in a pair of scrubs with my clothes in a garbage bag, because I don't want that to affect my dogs. And the fact I have English bulldogs at home, they are probably one of the breeds that if they do get sick are going to have really significant problems, because they have a hard time breathing, just being normal, let alone also having a respiratory infection on top of it.
Wow. So lots to worry about there, to think about at least. And then if you go home and just wash the clothes, you're going to be okay.
You should be fine. But remember, dogs, even after they're better from having a respiratory infection, can still shed this for about 3 weeks. So it's a very long quarantine period once we've had a dog diagnosed with this. And so that's one of the reasons why we have these issues, is that some dogs may not show a lot of symptoms. They get over it rather quickly, but then they're shedding it and can be affecting other animals, even while they look apparently normal.
Tom in Westby has a question for you, Sandy, so let's go there. Hi, Tom. Thank you for calling.
Hi, this is Tom from Westby, south of La Crosse.
Yeah, thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, I'm wondering... plants that cats would love, although we've learned our cat loves to chew all plants, to my wife's chagrin, but the plants that would be safe for a cat. I just bought some live basil, and I'm wondering if that would be safe for our cat, or what kind of plants.
Well, the one plant that is very, very toxic for cats are any of the lily plants that are the Asiatic-type lilies. So that would include some of the decorative lilies that you would have in your backyard, things like Easter lilies that you would bring into your house. And it's not just chewing on the plant. It is even just licking the pollen if they brush up against it. So we don't want to have those in our yard if you've got an indoor-outdoor cat, or in our homes for sure. Basil would be okay. That is one of the, like, an herb type thing. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I think that's interesting that your cat likes to eat that. But if your cat's really into chewing on plant material, you could plant things like oat grass. Some cats like that. That you can get catnip. And some cats like to chew it. Some, about 70%, will have a kind of hallucinogenic experience with it that just lasts for a short period of time. Appears to be very safe for cats to be able to chew on that. But again, that would be something in like the mint family. So any of the mint type plants, basil, parsley, those types of things would be fine. Absolutely no problem at all.
There you go. Thanks, Tom. Appreciate the call. Rod in Mason, it is your turn. Hi, Rod.
Hi. I just wanted to, I'm on a fixed income here, and I was trying to get a flea and tick collar for my dog. I've had prices all the way from $59 and $60 down to what I found at the tractor place for the same amount of protection for about $9. Why is so much difference in there?
It's the difference is the safety and the efficacy. The collar that there are a couple of collars on the market that work very well, and most flea collars are very ineffective. We will see some dogs come and cats coming in with fresh flea collars on and fleas just crawling right underneath them. So the collar that I find is the safest and probably the most effective is probably up in that $40-$45 range, and it's called the Seresto collar. It's made by the Bayer Company. It's extremely safe in that it's not going to, if your dog is swimming, it's not going to, the chemical isn't going to leach out into the water, so it's not going to be causing any environmental hazards. It's safe for use around cats because cats use exactly the same collar with the same chemical in it, just sized differently for dog than it is for dogs. So you can use it if you've got a multi-species household. It's safe for use around children as well, although it does say on the package, caution with children, and that's because it has little snap-on reflectors that can go on the collar that are there. I call it the bling, that are chokeable for children, and so just leave those off if you don't want to use them. So that would be the collar. If I had to say you want to get one, get that collar. It lasts for 8 months unless your dog is doing a lot of swimming, but bathing once a month doesn't decrease the efficacy. You know, jumping in the water with the collar on is not going to decrease the efficacy because it comes off with friction rather than water. And so that's one of the concerns I have with some of the inexpensive collars is the environmental impact that they can have. Those chemicals will leach out in water and can start affecting, you know, our wildlife if you've got a dog that's in the water all the time. So, you know, I think it's, even though you're on a fixed income, it's still probably the Seresto collar is the most economical and effective thing that you can use for flea and tick control. At about $40. Yep.
Yeah. There we go. Good luck. Thanks, Rod. Appreciate the call. Anita in Delafield up next. Hi, Anita. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a little Pomeranian who had to have her teeth cleaned, and she was anesthetized, of course. And now, when she came home, she started coughing, and coughing like hacking. And when we took her back to the doctor told us that her trachea was,
it was collapsing or irritated. Yes.
Yeah, and actually they did an X-ray, and the trachea seems to have thin, become not as big as it used to be, I suppose. But the problem is that now she has another problem with another teeth, which would require, again, putting her under because the teeth have to be removed. And I was worried about exposing her again to something similar that, when they compromise.
Yeah, this is the dilemma with these small breed dogs. They have all the same numbers of teeth as a large breed dog, and yet less bone attachment to be able to hold them in place and more crowding. And so as a result, a little bit of periodontal disease can cause very severe issues for these dogs. And so, you don't want to leave a dog with a painful mouth. And dentistry, as you found out, really needs to be done under anesthesia. Doing a conscious dental, which some people are doing it. I mean, it's like you'll see it advertised that I can clean your dog's teeth awake. What they're doing is just scraping off the visible tartar and not actually getting in the mouth and probing to see, do we have deep pockets? Do we have any fractured teeth? And they can't clean under the gum line. And so anesthesia is necessary. What you may want to consider doing, though, if your dog is an anesthetic risk because she has what we call a collapsing trachea, which is one of those issues that can affect a lot of small breed dogs, where the trachea, instead of being firm cartilaginous rings, they tend to be softer, and so they can collapse more. Sometimes treating these dogs after they've been intubated with medication like some cough suppressants or sometimes low doses of steroids and things like that can decrease some of the inflammatory change that may have occurred in that airway while it was being intubated. And so that would be something to work with a veterinary anesthesiologist. And, it's not uncommon to find veterinary anesthesiologists in certain specialty practices. In most regular practices, the anesthesia is done by the veterinarian and their well-trained technical staff. But if you're really, really concerned, consider going to a specialty clinic where there is an anesthesiologist on staff that can monitor the dog afterwards and perhaps even hospitalize them overnight to make sure that they don't have any airway issues, and to keep that coughing and that trachea from being an issue for them. But, don't avoid having those teeth taken care of, because you're just going to be asking for trouble later on. And once the teeth are taken care of, that's when you really need to be aggressive with your home care. Brushing is ideal, but there's some new treats. I talked about them last summer, and the FDA kind of got involved, and they couldn't get them on the market, but they're finally out now, and they're called the AuraVet Chews. They're by a company called Mariel, and they're little rectangular green chews with an active ingredient called dimopanol in there that, once the teeth are clean and your dog, gets one of these in their mouth, they just have to chew on it a little bit. It releases this chemical, and it keeps the plaque, the bacteria load on the teeth from being able to stick. And so it creates a real slippery surface, and so it helps keep the teeth longer, cleaner longer after they've had a professional cleaning done. So, yeah. So don't put off anesthesia. It can be done safely.
What about with our cats?
Same thing with cats. Cats get dental disease as well. And yet, our animals are so good at hiding oral pain. I had a kitty in the other day that had what we call a resorptive lesion, which is where the tooth starts to get eaten away right at the gum line. And when I pulled the lip back, the cat's mouth actually chattered, kind of like if we had a toothache, you know, or it hurts, you know. And this cat just literally chattered. And the owners are like, well, it's swallowing its food. It's eating still. But remember, cats swallow their 80% of their food whole anyways. They rarely ever chew their food. And cats are really good at manipulating the food in their mouth to avoid those uncomfortable teeth. So, you know, we see dental disease in cats just as much as we do in dogs. Sometimes some different types of diseases, like these resorptive lesions, and because they are painful, you know, you really have to have this cat under anesthesia to be able to do a good thorough exam, get x-rays, find the affected teeth, and be able to treat them.
And now Tiger and Coco, they chew on these, the little greenies they're called, and they seem to be helpful.
Yeah, they are. There are some approved treats and foods and things like that on the market. In an ideal world, every cat and dog would have their teeth brushed daily. But do I do it with my cats? No. I'm sorry. That would change our relationship. I've tried, but I can't do it. But if you go to, there's a website that is called VOHC. It's the Veterinary Oral Health Council, VOHC.org. They have a list on there of products that they feel are effective for dogs and cats at helping to eliminate plaque and tartar, or sometimes just tartar, sometimes just plaque. And greenies happen to be one of those things on the list. So great that you're using that. And they're big enough that they have to chew them.
Yeah.
And they are effective. The cats that I see getting those on a daily basis really have less dental disease, especially periodontal disease, than we do with cats that aren't eating something like that.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network. You'll now hear new voices and new perspectives during our evening lineup on the Ideas Network, with shows like Latino USA, which airs Tuesdays at 7 o'clock, so tonight at 7. And some of your old favorites have moved on to new times, like The Moth, Thursdays at 7. So you can see the entire schedule, learn about our new programs online at WPR.org. Kathleen Dunn talking about a recent survey focusing exclusively on parents' views of education. So that's at 1. Right now, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. Number to call, 800-642-1234, email at talk@WPR.org, or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Karen in Random Lake has a question for you, Sandy. Let's go there.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have an 8-year-old Welsh Terrier, and in the last 5 months, she's had emergency abdominal surgery twice because she, the first time she chewed on a throw rug, and it unraveled, and that yarn impacted in her intestine. And I think what caused that, they also found a little piece of rubber from a dog toy in her tummy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that probably had been there a while, upset her, and, she, you know, like she eats grass, and when she can't eat grass, she licks the floor.
Mm-hmm.
I happened to be gone on vacation when she was at the kennel when they discovered that. 5 months later, I went on vacation again, and she did the same thing, but this time she seemed to consciously seek out. We had taken up all the rugs we could possibly find, and she found a little piece of one that was under a wood box, and she did the same thing and had to have surgery again.
Wow.
So I was gone for a week both times, and, you know, in talking to my vet, we think that she probably associated the second time, associated, you know, the suitcases being packed. So now my concern is, if I go away again,
what do you do?
What
do I do? They've suggested, my vet did suggest that I perhaps, and she does get along very well at the kennel, she is also groomed at the same place, that I take her there a couple days ahead of time before I start packing.
Yep.
And I'm just wondering if She's not, she doesn't have anxiety, you know, separation anxiety at all.
Mm-hmm.
She is very, very, we're very, very close.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering if I should, if she should also get perhaps some anti-anxiety medication.
Yeah, anytime we're dealing, I mean, this is a very, you know, really strange case because most dogs with separation anxiety are going to be showing symptoms, even if you're just going out for an hour or two, are going to start showing signs of, uh-oh, you're getting your car keys, you're getting ready to go. It may be worse if you start pulling out things like suitcases where they realize you're going to be going longer. I think that, you know, having her in a boarding situation, definitely that would be a much safer place to be than being left alone and having a pet sitter coming to your house, especially if she's distressed. She may find other things that she could chew on.
Yeah.
When we see dogs licking and chewing on inanimate objects in a home, a lot of these dogs have actually been found to have some underlying gastrointestinal upset for some other reason. I like that first time with the plastic in her intestinal tract, and that may have been what started it. So I don't know, you know, if it's just coincidence that it happened again when you were getting ready to go, but I think your vet's idea of having her boarding and taking her there before she has a chance to get upset and get into trouble at home is a great idea. The anti-anxiety drugs that we use, many of them have an induction phase, meaning that you're not going to be able to see an effect until they've been on the drug for anywhere from like 2 to 6 weeks. Some of them work relatively quickly, like in the Valium type area, but they can be a little sedating. So that, you know, might be something that you could use for a short period of time, like a Xanax or Alprazolam or a Valium type drug, any of those types of drugs. There's another one that I use fairly commonly, even in hospital dogs, and it's called Trazodone. And it appears to be very safe and well-tolerated in dogs. It is not very sedating. So, again, that might be something to talk to your veterinarian about, especially if the dog is distressed when it's being boarded as well. But, yeah, you are correct in that once a dog has started, like, licking or chewing on a carpet, once we get those strings being swallowed, they just, you know, keep going. And,
yeah.
And it can be a huge problem for them. So it may mean, you know, keeping fringe carpets and things like that out of your house, which, you know, it just means you have to redecorate. But I hope your dog does well in the kennel. If they're happy there, that's the best place for them.
Absolutely. Well, thanks a lot for calling, Karen. Appreciate your call. And George in Oshkosh has something for us. Hi, George.
Hello. I have an English lab, and it's the very back tooth in its mouth has a chip in the enamel, and the tooth is discolored. I notice a little bit more drooling than normal. Would it be best to extract that tooth now, or should I wait till there's trouble down the road?
Oh, well, that's a really good question, because it's going to really depend on what a veterinarian finds when they evaluate that tooth. When we see teeth that are discolored, like a pink or a purpley type color, we call those devitalized teeth. And what that means is that the tooth has been damaged enough that the blood supply has been disrupted. And we'll sometimes even refer to them as a dead tooth. And there's like not a whole lot in the literature, but there was one paper that, you know, for looking at dogs with a devitalized teeth, and they found that 92% of those teeth will abscess because they've lost their blood supply and they're going to become infected over time. My guess is the tooth that's probably fractured in your dog's mouth is what we call the carnassial tooth, which is the huge, very functional chewing tooth in the mouth that is one of those very key teeth that the dog needs to be able to chew and handle their food and toys and so on appropriately. It also happens to be one of the teeth that, because they use that for chewing, we see fractures of. And it's because people will give their dogs things like natural bones, Nyla bones that are hard and not flexible. If you can't indent your finger in the dog's in the toy that you're giving your dog, it shouldn't go in the dog's mouth, because that's going to allow those teeth to fracture. So what I would recommend is going to see your veterinarian They'll probably say that your dog will need to be anesthetized to have that tooth evaluated. It's hard to do in an awake dog to get a probe up under the gum line. They'll likely take x-rays, and depending on what they find, if there's any bone changes by the roots indicating that it's already abscessed, they'll probably end up removing the tooth, and your dog will just have to function without it. But if they don't, if the tooth looks like they could save it, they may consider doing a root canal to be able to protect that tooth so that your dog will still have that functional tooth in its mouth. So I would get in sooner rather than later. If it is that carnassial tooth, it has three big roots and one of them sits very close to the eye, and we've seen abscesses coming out through the side of the face and sometimes in the eye socket area, and it can really be a mess. So this is the time to get them in and have that looked at.
Good luck, George. Thanks so much for calling. Just an aside question, have they done dental implants for dogs?
We don't, okay? We don't. But we do a lot of the things that they do with people, like root canals, vital pulp. They will sometimes do some restorations on the outside of the tooth. If there's just an enamel defect to smooth the tooth out to prevent, tartar and things from sticking, they can do things like that. But not the titanium implants.
Okay.
Not seen that done.
All right. I just wondered.
All right.
Norman in Wausau has a question. Hi, Norman.
Hi. I'd like to ask Sandy a question about Seresto. We have two golden retrievers, and last year we used the Seresto collars on them with excellent results. We live in the woods, and normally we have ticks, especially those deer ticks, all over us and the dogs, and we had none on them that we found.
Good.
Our one dog had a problem with the periorbital area, the eyebrow area, getting swollen, red, and itchy. And we tried a few things on it. Nothing seemed to help. Didn't think much of it. It kind of went away over the winter. And then about 2 weeks ago, we put the Seresto collars back on. And about a week after that, the same problem started again. So then I used some triamcinolone ointment, put it on a couple times a day, but it just kept on. So finally, we took the collar off about a week ago. And by golly, that thing is cleared up completely. So my question to you is, has this been reported before, and do you think this might be due to an allergic reaction to something in that collar?
It sure sounds like it, and this would be a case where I would be recommending contacting the company. They do have customer service people that like to know what's going on. And have I seen this type of problem with the collar? Absolutely not. We sometimes, and rare occasions, will see dogs developing a hypersensitivity reaction in the area where the collar sits. But that's very uncommon. I just wonder, we're just starting allergy season now, and the fact that it happened kind of, it was quiet during the winter when the collar was off, which is also when we don't see dogs having a lot of allergic dermatitis problems from pollens and molds and things outdoors. Is it just coincidental or not? But I think it would be a good idea to call the bear company and say, hey, this happened to my dog. One of the things that you may want to consider with the dog that has that kind of reaction, though, is maybe consider switching to one of the oral flea and tick products that are out there, because they are very effective as well. There's three of them on the market now. There's NexGard. There's another one called Brevecto. And then a third one called Simpatico. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm drawing a blank.
Simpatico?
But it's Simpatico, something like that. But I will get the name of it for you. But it's a new one that has just come out, and so you may want to consider. Here it is. It's called Simperica. That's it. Simperica is the collar, and it's made by the company called Zoetis, which is kind of the veterinary version of Pfizer. So those are all excellent products and do a very good job. And then there's nothing applied to the outside of your dog. And we found that even in heavy tick areas, people are quite pleased with the efficacy.
There we go. Good luck, Norman. Thank you so much for calling. And Margaret in Madison has something for us next. Hi, Margaret.
Hi. I'm taking care of our daughter's cat that's about 3 years old, maybe. And she loves to eat wool. She'll eat big holes in wool sweaters, wool socks, and she also eats holes in plastic bags. And she, you know, first of all, I'm worried that she might, you know, have a problem after ingesting those things. But is there anything we can do about it other than keep everything in closets?
Can I make a guess? Is the cat one of the, like, oriental breeds, like a Siamese, Burmese?
No, she is. Okay. She was adopted from a shelter. You know, she's just a, you know, tabby-looking cat.
Yeah.
She likes to go outside. She, you know, she's...
Yeah, this is a behavior problem that is not that common, but the reason why I brought up the fact, you know, was she a Siamese, is that they do tend to be very overrepresented for having this problem. And we call it, even though it's chewing on wool, we call it wool sucking. And it's considered to be a compulsive disorder that is fairly unique to cats. Some of these cats, if they're not, like, genetically primed, like the, you know, like the Siamese type cats, we'll see it if they were weaned too early and they start developing some non-nutritional sucking and chewing type behavior. We basically don't know why they start doing this. Sometimes it may be stress related. And the way we deal with it is, yes, making sure everything is kept up. You can't have plastic bags out. You have to put all, you know, knit materials and things away so that your cat doesn't eat it. Surprisingly enough, though, many of these cats that do this never obstruct. They chew it up fine enough that they're able to pass it. But that still is not a reason that I would leave it out and just say, oh, well, you know, they're going to eat holes and things. And, you know, Dr. Sawchuk says they're not going to obstruct. It could still happen. So we sometimes treat these cats with medications that are we use for compulsive disorders, usually one of the serotonin reuptake inhibitors, like a Prozac-type drug. Some of those cats do much better when they're on that type of thing. Those are quite helpful for compulsive disorders. Other times what we'll do is actually increase the fiber in their diet, increase, like, plant material that they can chew on, and then practice avoidance, having things just put away so that your cat can't get in trouble. It's a tough thing to deal with, and I'm sorry you're babysitting and having these issues, but
for sure.
You're going to have to redecorate your home until your daughter comes home and gives you permission to get that kitty into a vet to get him on some medication, and hopefully that'll get it under control.
Yeah, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. We have John emailing us to ask if rose geranium oil is effective and or safe to use on dogs. I'm not sure what you would use it for.
I am not sure what they would be using it for. You know, just because it's a natural product doesn't mean that it's safe. We know that, you know, things like lemon extracts and things that are used in a lot of the flea, like natural flea repellents, can have a fairly high toxicity rate. I don't know if it's, you know, what it would be used for or if it's safe, but maybe during the break I can look that up and see if we can find out for you.
Carla wonders, she has a small dog that likes baby carrots, wondering if that's a healthy snack, and he doesn't chew them all, and so you get some chunks appearing in the stool, and wondering if that's an issue.
It potentially could be if they swallow a huge chunk. It could potentially be a GI obstruction. I've never seen a dog get obstructed from a carrot, though, so I think it would probably be very safe to be able to feed your dog these carrots. You may want to consider cutting them up a little bit, even though baby carrots tend to be small, maybe cutting them in half to make sure that they're, you know, a little bit smaller going in, but they're a low-calorie treat, and we do recommend them if, you know, if we've got a dog, especially if they have to be on a diet and can't handle regular dog treats.
Well, Mike on Facebook wonders about ringworm for his cat. He's got...
Ringworm is one of those things that we do see fairly commonly in cats. It's usually in cats that are housed with other cats, so cats that come from shelter situations, barn situations where they've got close contact. It is one of those things where the treatment usually involves things like lime sulfur dips. There's some mousses that we can use now that are quite effective, that are a little bit easier than the dips. oral medications with oral antifungal drugs, and just know that this can be contagious to people as well and to other animals. So
you need to go to the vet.
You definitely need to go to the vet. Yeah. And don't assume just because the kitty has a patchy area of hair loss that it's ringworm. There are other things that can cause hair loss in the cat besides this particular fungus.
Gene and Colfax, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I heard you talking about the flea collars and et cetera. The one product I found is, I can't recommend it strongly enough, it's called Cedarside, and it's available from a company in Texas. It's made out of the West Texas red cedar sap or something. I think there's actually a juniper. I use it on my dog and cats, and it kills the fleas, repels the ticks. The salesman said it was so safe that one of his cohorts has even sprayed it in his mouth. And he said it tasted bitter for a while, but it's completely organic, and it works. It really works the best. They have both the a variety of products, the Cedarside for fleas and ticks, and they have some that's more of a repellent. You'd have to check the website. I don't have it handy right now. Cedarside.
Yeah, I wish flea and tick control could be that easy. I actually spent a summer working in Kansas with a fellow named Dr. Michael Dryden, and he is affectionately known in the veterinary world as Dr. Flea. And so I went to parasite camp and spent a lot of time, learning about all these things. And although you are finding that you maybe are having success with this particular product, there are virtually no natural products out there that are as effective as the things that veterinarians are recommending. And so I'm glad you're having good luck with it. But, be careful. Just because it says natural doesn't mean that if the animal ingests it, it's going to, it could potentially be an issue for them. So we always, just use it with caution. But when we start looking at controlled studies on natural products, we found that they are just not effective. Mm. So there's always going to be the exception, and I'm glad your pets are alive and happy and staying insect-free, but I would not be recommending it to my clients. Yeah.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us as we take a look at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Lots of folks online and ready to talk with you, so let's go next to Rolita in Platteville. Rolita, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thanks so much. I have a six-year-old, 110-pound German Shepherd, and he had TPLO surgery in October of 14th, and he couldn't tolerate it. And the plate was taken out in December of 14th. And I'm just wondering about the stability of that knee right now.
So what is that, by the way, Dr. Sandy?
Yeah, this is a surgery that's done for dogs that rupture their cruciate ligament. And so it's a cranial cruciate ligament similar to our ACL. This is a surgery that's done where the bone is actually cut and rotated. Obviously, I don't do surgery, but the surgeons at the vet school do. And there's a plate that holds everything in place. And so I assume when you said he didn't tolerate it, is that he was either having some infection around the plate and they had to remove it. It really depends. I mean, if that bone had healed well, that plate should be able to be removed if you had enough bone remodeling. It would really be based on x-rays. But remember, there's a high percentage of dogs that rupture their cruciate on one side. It can happen on the other side as well. And so I know your dog's 110 pounds, and that's a big German Shepherd. Hopefully their weight is okay. He's not overweight.
He is not overweight, and he would like to be very active, but he also blew out his other knee at the same time.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And we had such a bad experience with the first surgery. He had multiple infections and on antibiotics and pain pills and anti-inflammatories, and
last time we got done, it was around $6,000.
Mm-hmm.
So we haven't done the other one. And we keep him calm. Mm-hmm. He doesn't do anything slow.
Okay.
So it's difficult to keep him calm, but we do. He is just glued to me. So, you know, wherever I go, he goes with me, and we've worked on walking slow and not running. But I was just wondering about the stability of that with the plate out.
Yeah, and if the bone had healed fine after they have, you know, done the remodeling of the bone, mm-hmm. the plate should be able to be removed and
has been removed.
Yeah, okay. But it would all depend on what the X-rays look like afterwards. So, remember there are other surgeries that can be done other than TPLO. So I think it may be worthwhile talking to an orthopedic surgeon and just say, hey, my other dog, you know, the knee is gone. He had trouble with the plate. What you went through is very atypical. It's not a common occurrence to get all these complications afterwards. Most dogs, you know, bounce right back and after rest and the right physical therapy, they're back to leading a normal life, usually within a couple of months. So I'm so sorry that you went through all that, but don't, you know, limit your dog's life. They're 6 years old. He's got, you know, half his life plus to live. And to, you know, have to live with it being arthritic is not much fun. So maybe be looking into alternative surgeries rather than just the TPLO, because there are other ways that they can repair that joint.
Okay. All right.
All right. Thank you so much for calling, Relita. Appreciate it. And Stanley in Milwaukee, thank you for calling.
Oh, hello, Larry.
Hi.
And you're visiting Dr.
Sandy Sawchuk. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have a 13-year-old wire fox terrier, a female. She's very healthy, and her favorite snack is I give her a large milk bone dog biscuit, and I'll break it in half and sometimes in thirds, and she eats it pretty fast, but they're pretty hard. And I'm wondering, is there any chance that maybe she could crack a tooth or something chewing on
them? No, because they shatter, okay? Because you're able to break them in half and they shatter, shouldn't be a problem. It's the things that are so hard, like natural bones,
nylabones,
those types of things. Our dentist will say that if you hit yourself with it and it hurts, don't put it in the dog's mouth, because they have such good jaw strength that the tooth ends up breaking before the item that they're chewing on. But things like crunchy dog food, dog biscuits, those types of things, as long as your dog has no problems with obesity, no dental disease that's painful that would make the dog have difficulty chewing on them, I'd say by all means continue on with what you're doing. That's a good bonding experience for you and your dog.
Yeah, she sure likes them.
That's great.
That's great. Thanks, Dan. Stanley, appreciate the call. Oh, man. Yvonne in Barron County. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. Nice to talk to you. We have a between 8 and 9-year-old lab Doberman mix, and he's a wonderful personality dog. He's quiet and yet loves attention. But the last month or so, I have noticed that when he lays down to rest, he spends a lot of time in the house with us, I can hear him breathing. It's almost like a wheeze. And he doesn't seem sick. He hasn't indicated that he's not well in any way. And but I've never heard that before until just very recently.
And this doesn't happen when he's awake. It's just when he's sleeping.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
I've never noticed it when he's been awake.
Yeah. You know, as dogs age and as people age, I know that I snore now, you know. things can sometimes get, if they've gained some weight or they just get a little laxity in some of their, you know, tissues around their airways, you may see, you know, some changes in the noises when they're sleeping. I live with bulldogs, so I'm used to hearing all kinds of weird noises, you know, coming out of their respiratory system at night when they're asleep. You know, if your dog is exercising fine, has no nasal discharge, isn't mouth breathing, moving air in and out of the nostrils fine, I think this is probably just a result of maybe aging a little bit, and I really wouldn't worry about it. But one thing that you could do is take a video of it, with sound, obviously, so that you can show it to your veterinarian when you go in for one of your appointments and just say, this is what my dog does at night, because, you know, they may be able to see something that you're not seeing. And mm-hmm. it's wonderful to have people have that capability now with, you know, all the cell phones and so on. It really helps us in practice to, you know, actually see and hear what your dog is doing. So, but it probably is nothing.
Well, I'm hoping that's the case.
Okay.
All right. Good luck, Yvonne. Barron County. Oh, I did some of my PhD research way back when in Barron County.
There you go.
So I have a fondness for Barron County, for sure. Tony in Mount Horeb, we turn to you next. Hi, Tony. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. Say, yet another Seresto collar question.
Okay.
Cat veterinarian is recommending one, as well as topical application of Revolution Monthly. Cat is indoor, outdoor supervised, and her feeling is that the collar is better for ticks.
Uh-huh. This is a big issue, is that we don't have products for cats that are going to cover flea, tick, and heartworm all combined, and intestinal parasites. We've got products that will do heartworm, fleas, and intestinal parasites. That would be something called Advantage Multi. We've got Revolution that does fleas and heartworm and some intestinal parasites. But ticks are something that we need to be more concerned about with cats in Wisconsin. In the past, we weren't worried about them because they're very resistant to the tick-borne diseases that dogs get, like Lyme disease and anaplasma. And cats are so good at grooming that, you know, if you do get the odd tick on them, it's usually around their face and they can't get it off, but it's they typically get them off before they cause any trouble. But now there's this other tick that has managed to make its way into our state called amblyomma, or the Lone Star tick. And it carries a disease that can be fatal for cats that's called cytozoonosis. And it's something new that we're seeing. I picked off an amblyomma tick, a male, off of myself from my backyard. So I know that I live in Janesville, and, you know, right, you know, just on the border. So they're there, and I'm got a little, you know, dot on a map on campus here with our parasitologists. That's why I'm always recommending to people, if you pull ticks off the dog, I want to see them, because I want to know kind of what we have in our area, because it'll give me a better chance for helping people like you with their cats, saying, yeah, we better use something for tick control. And so, unfortunately, it does mean for cats that you have to double up on things, using something like the Seresto collar as well as something topical for heartworm, which, it can be a fatal disease for cats as well. So I think your vet's doing a great job of keeping your cat protected.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And Bob in Wauwatosa, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for a great program, as usual. I've got a question about what the green plants in our yard, our 8-month-old puppy can or should not eat. Hostas is one specifically.
As they're coming up now, he's chewing on them?
She is.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
She tries to.
Yeah. And I think that that's really important when we have young pets or even older pets that like to eat things out in the backyard, that you're out there supervising them so that she knows that, you know, chewing on your decorative plants is, you know, not okay, but I can chase a ball or do something else. So it means being out there with them and redirecting to something else. I just had somebody send me a really interesting picture, and I thought, what a great idea. They just, to keep their pet from, like, walking in the garden, they took plastic forks, okay, and put the handle in the ground so that the spines of the plastic fork are poking up as a deterrent to keep pets, because that's going to hurt if they walk into it. So I thought, oh, that would be something easy and safe and inexpensive. I, you know, learning about all the toxic plants that are out there, it's really difficult for me to keep up with everything. So I always refer people to like either the Animal Poison Control Center or I know that the Humane Society has a very good website on toxic plants for pets. I think probably the one thing that is not a plant material that, or not a plant, a living plant, that but people use in their yards is cocoa bean mulch. Extremely toxic for dogs. It looks nice. It's got a kind of a chocolate smell, but there's enough active ingredients still in that mulch to cause your dog to have chocolate toxicosis. So that would be something to not consider using. But before you put any plants in your yard, you always want to, you know, do some research to make sure that they are going to be safe if your pet does happen to sample them.
There we go. Thanks a lot, Bob, for calling. Sharon posted she thinks her 12-year-old cat may have a tooth infection, doesn't have a lot of money. What can she do to make the cat more comfortable?
Oh, this is a tough one. You know, there are some low-cost clinics and things that can do dental care. And so I'd be looking in your area and maybe talking to a veterinarian and just letting them know this. I know at the veterinary school, we have something called a Respond Fund for people that are on limited income that give them a one-time grant. I think it's $700 or $800. And so, you know, there are options like that out there. So rather than have your cat just live with something, do a little homework, do a little questioning, and you may be surprised at what can be done for you and your kitty.
All right. There we go. Thank you so much for that question. We have lots of calls, lots of questions up here, and we'll be able to deal with those questions after we take a look at the news. Our guest today, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, a professor in the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. She comes by once a month to talk, and she'll actually be back again soon, almost exactly a month from now, as a matter of fact. In the meantime, have an open line at 1-800-642-1234 and send us a note here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. So happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Join in at 1-800-642-1234. A question about your pet. Actually, all our lines are filled right at the moment, you can also email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. Deborah in Winona, Minnesota is up next. Deborah, hi. Thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a 12-year-old cat, and about 2 months ago, I took him in to have his teeth and ears cleaned, and he woke up deaf. And our veterinarian thinks at this point, since he hasn't gotten his hearing back yet, that it's permanent. And I'm wondering what Dr. Sawchuk thinks about this and if she thinks maybe acupuncture might help.
I doubt that acupuncture would help. It won't hurt a 12-year-old cat. We probably could benefit from it in other regards. But when the cat had its ears cleaned, that's what I'm really concerned about. Did they flush and damage the eardrum? What method did they use to be able to clean the ears? Did they instill some medication afterwards that may have been ototoxic, because there's certain antibiotics and things that we have to be really careful with when we've got a ruptured eardrum. And in many of those cases, the hearing loss can be permanent. So, as long as your kitty is a, totally indoor cat, they can usually adjust just fine. They may startle a little bit easier, so you need to make sure that you give them a little vibration or a little warning ahead of time that you are approaching rather than just touching them. But I'm so sorry that that happened. But at this point, it probably is not going to be coming back. Yeah.
He is totally indoor, and does seem to be adjusting to it.
Good.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot for calling. Bridget in Appleton, your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. I have a 12-year-old golden retriever, and he is, first of all, the love of our life, but he's getting old and kind of snippy. He's on glucosamine for his hips, and then we have him on, I can't remember what it is, but it's like ibuprofen for dogs to help some of the inflammation. And what is happening is he is getting really snippy, and he's, of course, it's harder for him to get up. And so, you know, we're thinking that as he gets older, that's going to happen. Our major concern, though, is the snippy part. He did he bit at a little neighbor boy who was at our house. He didn't break the skin, but it's enough to make us kind of worry, and he's growling. So,
if
there's another placement or what we can do for him.
Well, the first thing I'd always want to do is make sure that you've ruled out medical reasons why your dog may be having a behavior change. Definitely just chronic pain can be causing this as well. And we do know that dogs that have pain can get wind-up pain, meaning that it would be like if you hit your finger with a hammer, okay, it's going to hurt. But now you just barely touch your finger against the wall and it's going to hurt a lot. And that's what we call wind-up pain. And so there's, the drugs that you have your dog on may or may not be enough to be able to help with that. And it may mean hiking up the amount of pain control, things like adding in gabapentin, amantadine, maybe looking at switching to a different non-steroidal anti-inflammatory. You'd have to go through a washout period before you add a new one in. Maybe looking at other alternative pain control like acupuncture to see if that may help your dog. You want to also rule out things like hypothyroidism, which can make dogs very grumpy and irritable, especially if he was a good boy and had no issues before, and this is kind of a sudden change for him, then that would be more indication that there's something organically wrong with him that needs to be addressed. If he's always been a little bit grumpy throughout his life, it may just be that, combinations of I'm getting older, I can't get up, and I can't get away from the things that scare me, like the neighborhood kid. So I'm going to have to, growl and snap to be able to keep the boogeyman away. If you've ruled out all the medical things, you've got him on sufficient pain control, then I think it's time to be looking at getting involved with an applied animal behaviorist to actually assess what's going on with him. And this would be your veterinarian would likely be able to recommend somebody in your area that would be able to come. This is not a dog trainer. This is somebody that, deals with problem behaviors like this and not just obesity. So it's you may have to travel a little bit with your boy to be able to get some help. But I think at this point in his life, being a 12-year-old, he's been part of your family for so long. I think it really would be worth it.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling, Bridget. Appreciate your calling. Good luck with your dog. Jim in Wauwatosa is up next. Dr. Sandy, let's go there. Hi, Jim.
Hi. How you doing?
Great. Appreciate the call.
I've got a question. We've got a 10-year-old cat, and about 2 months ago, it started sneezing a lot. And it'll sneeze 10 times in a row within about a minute. And between each sneeze, lick its nose. Next sneeze, lick its nose. The veterinarian said it could be an allergy, so they said give it a half of a Zyrtec once a day, see how that works. It hasn't made any difference. We changed foods, two or three different varieties, hasn't made a difference. Should we ignore it? What do you think?
How old is your cat? I'm sorry, I missed that part.
About 10 years old.
10 years old. Few things that I get concerned about. One would be dental disease. Remember, those tooth roots sit up very close to the nasal passages, and sometimes we can see what are called oral nasal fistulas that can cause irritation in the nose. And so, again, that would be, having your cat's teeth assessed. It may require anesthesia to be able to have that done. Your cat is also at an age where we can start seeing things like nasal tumors that can be irritating. When they're asleep for having their teeth evaluated, they may need to, have a CT scan done of their skull or, rhinoscopy, having a look up in there to see what's going on. I would be, thinking that this needs to be addressed. This, obviously, if the cat's sneezing that frequently and licking afterwards, it's got to be bothersome for the kitty. And they're still, even though they're 10, that's still relatively young in cat years. So we want to make your cat comfortable as they head into their senior years. So teeth, nasal exploratory type type thing with some imaging or scoping, I think would be in the cards for your kitty.
There we go. Hey, Jim, thank you. Mike in Rhinelander, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Let's see, I got a 17-year-old kitty, and the problem we've got with him is that he's really sneaky at sneezing. He'll be laying on her chest and sneeze right in our face about every month or two. So I'm not so much worried about his sneezing. I'm wondering about our health. Is there any kind of issues with a cat sneezing right in your face and eyes that we should be worried about?
Besides that it's kind of socially unacceptable, no, yeah. Probably not. There's very few respiratory diseases that cats get, actually none that I can think of, that would be a problem for us. I mean, if you are immunocompromised, you have open sores on your face, you know, something like that, then there's that potential for nasal bacteria to be able to, you know, come out and infect you. But, if you've got a happy, healthy, normal respiratory system and skin, it's, you know, it's just kind of like one of those things where, you know, you deal with it. I have been sneezed on all my life by so many cats you would think that if there was something to be concerned about, I would have caught it by now. So don't worry. Just, you know, try to act quick when you see your cat ready to sneeze.
There you go, Mike. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. That happened to me the other night. About 3 o'clock in the morning, Coco is sort of nosing around my face and wake me up and then sneezes.
Yeah, it happens. It happens, yep.
Tracy in Green Bay up next. Hi, Tracy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a cat who will be 17 in June, and I had her brother as well. We had to put him down just over 2 years ago due to heart-related complications from sort of advanced hyperthyroidism. And these are medium-haired cats, and I didn't really recognize he was getting all that much thinner, and I think we just didn't catch it in time to really mm-hmm. do well with him. Well, right around the time that we let go of him, his sister started to develop some of the same symptoms he had been having earlier on, and so we got her on a medication regimen much sooner, and she is on, I don't remember the name of the medication, but it's the salve that you put inside the ear.
Yeah, it's called methimazole, it's available in a tablet form as well as in a bio gel that can be applied. And the reason we put it on the inside of the cat's ear flap is that's a hard spot for them to groom, and there's a lot mm-hmm. of very small blood vessels there, not a lot of hair, so the medication's able to be absorbed. It's one of the few topical drugs that we can use in cats that we know is effective.
Yeah. So I guess my concern is that when he first started to develop, you know, when I first brought him in, the salve was sort of new, pretty new, in fact. And the vet that I worked with, I go to the same office, but I work with a different vet now, wasn't exactly sure because she hadn't ever prescribed it before. Now that it's kind of more of an established method, we've already upped the dosage from one full rotation to two in my kitty that we have left. And I'm wondering, you know, because it seems like it's pretty progressive, like hyperthyroidism just kind of continues to get worse, almost like they grow immune to the dosage of the medication.
Mm-hmm.
What's next?
Yeah, that's why we monitor these cats. Many of them need to have their dosages tweaked, as they get older and maybe lose a little bit of weight. But for the most part, most cats get on a dose and are able to stay with it. But in the first usually few months, we're usually making some changes. So the BioGel has been around for a long time. It's not new. I've been using it now for probably a good 15 years or so, and so I've had really good success with it. If it's applied appropriately, owners are measuring it appropriately, but it still requires that you bring your cat in to have thyroid levels checked periodically, at least initially, and then annually to every 6 months, depending on the age of the cat, to, you know, make sure that we don't have to adjust the medication. Other alternatives that you may want to consider if you're getting tired of the topical medication is there's actually three other things that can be done. The first one I'm going to mention I would not recommend, and that would be surgical removal of the thyroid, the goiter. One, your cat's older, they're at more of an anesthetic risk, and you run the chance of damaging the parathyroid glands, which control calcium phosphorus balance. And so, it was something that we did years ago when we didn't have medication. We would send these cats to surgery, but we don't do that anymore. There is radioactive iodine is another method where they come into a hospital that is licensed to be able to do this. It's a quick injection of a radioactive iodine, and they just hang at the clinic until, in a special kind of lead-lined room, until their Geiger counter level drops, and that will suppress the thyroid function. And then lastly, there's a diet on the market that is called YD by the Hills Company. It is a severely iodine restricted diet that it helps control hyperthyroidism. The downside with that diet is they can't eat anything else. They have to only get that. Even a mouthful of something else can throw off their regulation. And I don't look at it as an appropriate diet for geriatric cats. It's just, the protein levels and so on. It's just, I'm not happy with it. When you've got a cat that's in this catabolic state of being hyperthyroid, to have them on a diet like that. So I've had very limited experience with it. I've got a couple of patients on it, but my preference is either using the gel or the oral medication or radioactive iodine. Those would be the methods that I would be recommending.
Okay, yeah, and I am feeding her. I didn't realize. I thought that was a newer drug, actually. In fact, the vet that I worked with, not with my male cat, said it was newer, so she must have been really not well informed on it, but or maybe she hadn't heard of it before. But I do also feed her high calorie soft food to help her keep her weight up.
Good. Yeah, and I think so. Putting her on YD would not be an appropriate thing for your kitty right now. And if you're happy with the medication and okay with, the monitoring that needs to be done, just stick with that. And it's not going to, increase that much. But the first few months, it's trial and error to get the right dose for each kitty.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot for calling. I appreciate your call. And Susan in Summit, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a barn kitty that we noticed fell off the hay when she was jumping down, and then we watched her, and she had looked like a vestibular problem. So we took her to the vet, and it was called an idiopathic vestibular problem. Mm-hmm. They said, just take her home. So we kept her indoors, but then a day later, her eardrum ruptured, and she had this horrible drainage.
Okay.
So we took her back and put her on Clavamox for over a month. So we've had her in the house. She's not a house cat, but she's in the house. And she is finished with her antibiotics, but she still has vestibular problems. Is this permanent, and is she ever going to be able to go outside?
Yeah. Unfortunately, I think the veterinarian made a misdiagnosis saying it was this idiopathic vestibular disease. There's a condition that we see in dogs and cats. It's similar to Meniere's disease in people, where they, suddenly wake up in the morning and the world is spinning. And it's usually self-limiting. They may have some residual head tilt minor symptoms later, but most of them get better in a matter of a few days. What your cat experienced was probably an inner ear infection, and that's what caused the balance apparatus to be out of whack, and that may be permanent. Sometimes even after we've treated the infection, there may be enough damage done to the balance apparatus that they may always have a head tilt or, be ataxic and have difficulty getting around. And so I think what you have now is probably a permanent indoor kitty, because at letting her be out in the wild where she has to defend, well, not wild, in your barn, where she may have to defend herself and hunt for a living, is going to be more difficult for her. So she may continue to improve as she learns to compensate for her problem, but she will likely never be 100% normal.
Okay, so now I have six indoor kitties.
There you go.
Have fun, Susan.
Yes.
All right, appreciate your call very much. Oh, man. Lauren in Gays Mills has a 3-year-old dog who's getting white hair in several spots. Could this be a sign of heartworm?
No, I've never heard of hair color change being caused by heartworm. Heartworm is a parasite that is spread by mosquitoes, and it is a parasite that, when it matures, is living in the blood vessels and the heart area. And it should be called probably pulmonary artery worm disease would be a better name for it. I have not seen that. And usually when we start seeing white hairs showing up, it may just be premature aging, which we can see just why the same why reason why some people in their 20s will start to get white hair. It's sometimes we will see hair color change in areas where the hair follicles have been damaged, either secondary to a skin infection, maybe an area where an injection of something irritating that was done. But it is not due to heartworm, I can tell you that.
Okay, there we go. Well, Josie in Wonder Lake, Illinois, emailed to say that the woman who had the 12-year-old lab was having noises, making noises when sleeping. She had the similar problem. Her Springer developed a labored sound when, and it turned out to be caused by lymphoma and swelling of the glands in the neck affecting her breathing passage.
Right, and definitely. So if you have a change like that in your dog, that's where you do need to have them looked into. Hopefully for this other dog, it's nothing. But yes, anything that increases lymph node size, tonsil size, anything like that could be causing some trouble. I would just be expecting that if it was something as serious as lymphoma, this dog would have been showing some symptoms when it was awake as well, and this dog isn't. It was just showing it when he was sleeping.
Oh, okay, there we go. Dana emailed to say that she brought a 5-year-old rescue dog into her home. Her 13-year-old poodle isn't happy with it, but apparently she has access to another 13-year-old poodle.
Oh, you know, not every dog wants a playmate, and some dogs are just happy being the only dog in the family. So when someone says to me, should I bring another dog in? Do you think it would be helpful? You always have to say, well, how does your dog get along with other dogs? If you have friends that bring their dogs over and the dog is happy and oh my goodness, we've got a buddy over here, then by all means, go for it. But it may just be that your dog is happy being the only dog and doesn't want to share you or the house with anybody else. And so perhaps adding in even the same breed at the same age is still going to be a problem if it's not what your dog wants.
Oh, well, I can understand that.
And, I'm bringing a new dog in myself on Thursday.
Yeah,
I've got got an 11-week-old puppy named Stanley coming to my house. He's a bulldog that has some pretty severe orthopedic issues, and so it needs to live with a veterinarian who can do physical therapy. He's probably going to need some surgery done at some point. But I now have a Bruce, a Pete, and soon to be Stanley.
And most of your pets come with some sort of medical ailment.
They all do. Okay. So, yeah, but that's well, one of the reasons why I'm a veterinarian is I can help pets like this and give them a good life and a good home and keep them comfortable and happy.
Well, I tell you what, it's great to have you with us. And your pets are darn lucky.
I think so, yes.
I think they are, too. Oh, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. And she will be back, on May 10th is the second Tuesday of the month.
All right.
Is May 10th, just a few days before my birthday. And so we'll look forward to her next visit at that time. Just to take a look ahead to see what's coming up. At 1, Kathleen is going to be talking about a recent survey focusing on parents' views on education. And tomorrow on this program, David Drake and Jamie Knack will be back from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology, and we'll be taking a look at the wonderful world of wildlife here in Wisconsin. Thank you so much for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.